you.
How do you think you can harness these great feelings of optimism and pride in Grimsby going forward?
Well, I mean, I hope that the feeling stays for longer than a day. And I do think that, you know, there is something in people's psyche. If your team are doing well, then you do feel a bit more positive about things and about life. And I'm hoping, one, that the club can continue to do well through the competition. So, you know, we'll keep our fingers crossed for that. And then really just for people to recognise that there are some really brilliant things going on in the town, some really dedicated people running different community organisations, grassroots activities, local businesses. And, you know, it's very easy to focus on the negatives, but perhaps to look a bit more closely at the positives and champion
those. Indeed. Well, that is a fine note to end Times at One and the interview with Melanie On, the Labour MP. Grimsby, after that stunning victory, Grimsby Town over Manchester United last night. That is all we have time for today. Thank you very much to the team on the Times at One, and Fee and Jane are in the studio now.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Joe, and good afternoon. It's 2 o'clock. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover until four.
And coming up on our programme today, more on why Tony Blair is advising the White House on Gaza. The angry, bitter alcoholic, the Alzheimer's victim or the sweet-knitting granny. Is that all to life after 60 if you're a woman on the screen? And our big interview is with the art historian James Fox, whose new book is about Britain's vanishing craftspeople. Is that you?
And let's start with the news at two. Martin Williams.
Keir Starmer has accused Vladimir Putin of killing children and sabotaging hopes of peace after drone and missile strikes on Kyiv overnight. A British council building and EU offices were hit. Authorities in the Ukrainian capital say at least 16 people have been killed, including a two-year-old. Russia says it was targeting military factories and air bases. Ursula von der Leyen is the EU Commission President.
I'm outraged by the attack on Kyiv, also hitting our EU offices. Two missiles hit in a distance of 50 metres of the delegation within 20 seconds. And this is another grim reminder of what is at stake. It shows that the Kremlin will stop at nothing to terrorise Ukraine, blindly killing civilians, men, women and children, and even targeting the European Union.
The Treasury is considering a tax increase for landlords. The Times understands officials are examining proposals to apply national insurance to rental income in the hope of raising £2 billion to shore up public finances. The property expert Kirsty Allsop has told Times Radio it's a terrible idea that will damage the property market.
You have 1,000 young people in your office who are tenants because nobody who works in London can afford to buy anymore. They will all tell you that they have to move all the time because their landlords are permanently selling up. When you make it so unattractive to be a landlord, what do the landlords do? They leave and rents go up and the market becomes more restricted. This is tenant bashing under the guise of landlord bashing.
The Court of Appeal has been told a decision to block asylum seekers from being housed at a hotel in Essex creates a risk of a precedent being set. The Home Office is challenging an injunction secured by a local council following recent protests outside the Bell Hotel in Epping. Lib Dem leader Sir Ed Davey is to boycott Donald Trump's state banquet next month in a protest against his position on Gaza. He says he and his wife have spent all summer thinking about it and have prayed about it. Here's Times Radio's Theo Usherwood.
He says boycotting the banquet is one way I can send a message to Donald Trump and Keir Starmer that they can't close their eyes and wish this away. We have to speak up. The Shadow Foreign Secretary, Priti Patel, has criticised the Liberal Democrat leader, saying that his decision to boycott the state banquet is a great act of disrespect to his Majesty the King.
And Asda says its £1 billion IT upgrade is to blame for customers facing temporary disruption to products available to them in stores and online. The UK's third largest supermarket chain insists it's now finished rolling out the system change, which it claims is potentially the biggest in Europe, maybe ever. Its parts of plans for a major turnaround strategy after a dip in sales. And for a roundup of the news on demand, you can subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Good afternoon, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover with you this Thursday afternoon until 4 o'clock. Hope you're well. What have we got for you? Well, it is 4 years to the day since the last British flight out of Kabul as the Taliban took over again. We're going to be talking to a leading Afghan politician who got out, it has to be said, with the help of the British authorities. What a story she has. When she was 25, she was lashed in public by the Taliban for the crime, in speech marks, of trying to get help from a female doctor. We'll hear from her a little later in the programme. We'll talk about older women in film, often drunk, occasionally rather bitter, every now and again allowed to be just a little bit witty. Will this ever change? Will older women ever get centre stage on screen, if that makes sense, as action heroines, Fee, with much younger male, if we're going to be heteronormative, love interests? What do you think?
Well, it would be a movie or a show that you and I would revel in watching, wouldn't it?
Will it ever happen?
I hope so. Yeah. I do hope so.
Okay. Well, Sarah Dyson is.
I thought you were describing our show, actually. Well, the beginning there. Although we're not drunk, just sound it.
I'm just trying to digest a little finger of fudge, if I'm honest. Right. Later in the programme, too, have you ever been nabbed by Ryanair for trying to sneak a chunkier than officially allowed bit of luggage on board? Be honest, has that person been you? That's later. And Jane Mulcairns joins us with news of the weekend's Times magazine this week. The author of Wild Swans, on why she can never return to her homeland of China. Dan Whitlam, the Gen Z poet, and the former glamour model Keely Hazel on her reinvention. She is now 38. She lives in the States. And she talks very frankly about what it was like to be a so-called page three model back in the day and the impact of all that on her. And our big guest after Hoppers 3 is...
It's James Fox, who is a cultural historian. He's made BAFTA award-winning documentaries. He's written books about colour. He lives part of his life in academia. And he's written a book called Craftland, A Journey Through Britain's Lost Arts and Vanishing Trades. I'd just like to read you a couple of the chapter headings because I think this will tell you what it's all about. There's a chapter called Into the Woods, Down the River, Cask Strength, Steel City, The Crucible, The Watchmaker's Apprentice. It's a celebration of those times when we all had to do something with our hands in order to make our lives easier, better, richer, whatever it was. And if you think it's just going to be some kind of footbath of nostalgia, don't worry, because actually the stories that he tells are really personal and really interesting. And it's just about progress through time as well. We spend a lot of time on this programme damning technology, don't we? Because the dark side of it has well and truly emerged. But it gives us great things too. And it's one of the things that we will talk about after 3:30, just where it's right to mourn the loss of craft and trade, and when it's right to go, well, it's good that nobody has to die building a wall anymore.
Well, that is good.
So all of that to come.
Yeah. I think many of you listening might still be getting over the encounter that Fee had yesterday with the chatbot Maya. It does take a little bit of getting over. It's one of those encounters, if you didn't hear it, you'd need to go back to, what time is it, about 3:30, just before...
I think it's about 2:30.
Okay. Really strange conversation that Fee had with a chatbot. And it's one of those interviews. I wonder how it will sound in 10 years' time.
Well, we will have been replaced by chatbots. I'm not saying that in a kind of, tabloid headline-y way. But realistically, the ability to ask questions, keep a conversation going, all of that type of stuff is well within the grasp of AI already. And, you know, nobody would have to put up with our bad moods, our chocolate choices, our incessant gossiping, just be able to plug something in at 2 o'clock and plug it out again at four.
I don't want to hear any more of this conversation. Let's have a quick gander before we move on to the most read stories on the Times website this afternoon. At number three, midlife is no longer the age of peak misery. For the first time in generations, the average 22-year-old is likely to be unhappier than their parents, which isn't really brilliant news if you have a 22-year-old or you're currently living with one. I'm not sure I really... it's a bit grim from the perspective of the older generation, in truth. The second most read story is Manchester United humiliated by Grimsby in the shootout epic after the Onana howler. That's the Manchester United goalkeeper. That is Paul Hurst's analysis of that shocking game for Manchester United fans last night. And the most read piece on the Times website is landlords could face national insurance on rental income in the budget. The Treasury is thinking about a tax increase for landlords in an attempt to boost revenue by targeting unearned income in Rachel Reeves's budget, which is coming our way in October. I still don't think we've got the date, but there's going to be endless speculation about what might be in that budget over the coming weeks. Now, all of these articles on thetimes.com, you will need your digital subscription. If you don't have one, why not get one by going to thetimes.com/subscribe.
It's America where we start today. Tony Blair is advising the White House on Gaza. President Trump held a major meeting yesterday about the future of the enclave, featuring the former prime minister. The US assistant editor has the story on the front page of today's Times. We can talk to him now. David Charter, very good evening from very good afternoon. I'm wishing my life away from us in London town. It's such a good story, David, and I think an awful lot of people, their eyebrows will have gone higher than a hair clip at reading it. What exactly is known about the meeting? And presumably because there aren't any photographs available, are people pretty annoyed in both camps that we're talking about it?
Yeah, well, it's good morning from here in Washington, actually. The meeting was kept very quiet yesterday. I went over to the White House a couple of times, actually, to try and find out who was attending and how long it went on for. And there really was a veil of secrecy thrown over this one. It was exposed, first of all, by a reporter from Axios News website, said that both Sir Tony Blair and Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, who's married to Ivanka and has an interest, a lot of interest in the Middle East, they'd both be attending. And this has been confirmed, although that no details of the meeting were given out, apart from to say they really wanted to play it down. They were saying it was a routine policy consultation exercise. It wasn't really a big decision-making meeting. It was a consultation on what we know of Trump's plans for Gaza, which he set out way back in February when Benjamin Netanyahu became the first national overseas leader to visit the Oval Office. And you remember President Trump was talking about a Riviera for the Middle East and America taking over the Gaza Strip to rebuild it as a resort destination. We've heard nothing to the contrary from the Tony Blair Institute, for example. They were very reluctant to talk about it as well when we contacted them yesterday. And so far, they're refusing to give any details of what Sir Tony is telling Donald.
Which just makes people even more intrigued, shall we use that word. I know that the Tony Blair Institute, you've written about this in your piece too, seems to be keen to say that Tony Blair has never authored or promoted a plan, or the Institute has never promoted a plan to relocate or displace Gazans. But obviously, Jared Kushner presumably does back Trump's vision of, as you've described it, this Riviera, which immediately people pointed out would have to displace and relocate Gazans.
That's right. We know that Kushner has talked in the not too distant past about the real estate prospects of Gaza. Before the Trump administration came into power, actually, he did talk about how it had a lot of prime beachfront potential to become a resort as a resort destination. And not only that, there were groups of prominent Israeli business people who have drawn up plans that have been also been discussed by the ruling parties to create Dubai-like islands in the sea off of the coast to put hotels on as a destination. So those things are in the air, but we don't know how far down the line they're going at the moment. Because as Steve Witkoff, the special envoy, Donald Trump's property magnate friend, who is the peace envoy for the Middle East, he has reminded us that it'll take months, years, really, to make the land safe, because there's so much ordnance needs to be cleared, all the basic facilities required for modern life, sewage, electricity, water, it all needs to be refashioned and remade because it's a devastated area.
Yeah.
It's been absolutely smashed to smithereens.
How much is known, David, about the exact work that Tony Blair has done over the last, let's just say, 10 years in the Middle East? And the TBI is the Tony Blair Institute. That's not a government body. It doesn't have to tell us everything it does it?
No, well, it doesn't. It's involved in consultations extensively on potential projects for the Middle East, because that's clearly, you know, Sir Tony was a Middle East envoy for a high-powered group involving the EU, the US, the UN and Russia for 8 years immediately after he left office in 2007, I think it was. And so he's got extensive contacts. He's actually had several meetings, actually more like a dozen meetings over the years, with a gentleman who is now very senior in Hamas, who's not a Gazan, but he plays a very senior role in that organisation. And so Blair does know people very well on both sides, and he's got his finger in a lot of pies over there. But it's even more frustrating for us because they won't tell us what he's actually promoting. Apart from, he did give an interview late last year to Politico, where he talked about how it couldn't be Hamas and it couldn't be Israel that ends up running the Gaza Strip. It had to be a third organisation. But what he hasn't said, intriguingly, is whether this should be the Palestinian Authority, which is the elected Palestinian leadership on the West Bank, not in Gaza, of course. Hamas won the election in 2006 and have been in power ever since. So we don't know exactly what this third authority is that he thinks should run the place.
Yeah. Well, let's park all of that just for now. There's so much else to talk about, David. Elsewhere in the White House, there's been this firing of the head of the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. What would be the nearest comparative body that we would have in the UK, which would help us to understand who this person is, Susan Menares, and how important the position?
Oh, well, it's a very senior role, like a very senior bureaucrat at the Department of Health, or NICE, that is deeply involved in setting the medical agenda for the country. So verifying what drugs can be used and the schedule for vaccinations, for example, which seems to be at the heart of this, because Robert F. Kennedy Jr., you'll remember, is the health secretary in America. He's a vaccine skeptic. He's talked about how he believes vaccines cause autism. And one of the things he's planning is a big press conference next month to reveal his findings of an inquiry into the causes of autism, the recorded cases of which have been going up and up and up over the last 20 years. And so we expect to hear some sort of link with vaccination coming from him. But the immediate trigger that may have played a role in the disputes at this body, the Centers for Disease Control, which has seen not only the head forced out after barely a month in office, but four other senior officials have resigned in protest last night. And in a really detailed resignation letter, one of those is the director of the National Centre for Immunisation. And so he's been saying that it's the changes made by RFK that are behind this. He can't support them anymore because RFK fired there's an advisory body on what vaccinations should be given and when to different age groups and different vulnerabilities, etc. Well, RFK Jr. fired them all in May and put his own people in who are vaccine sceptic. And so what then happened was the new advice on COVID vaccinations was that they're no longer advised for healthy children. So those up to the age of 18 are no longer advised to get any COVID vaccination. And that has a big knock-on effect in America because it means that some of the insurance companies won't reimburse parents for if they do get their kids vaccinated, and that's going to be a deterrent cost of I think I saw it was over $100, $150 maybe per vaccination. So you can see how this has is going to have a major effect on this year's vaccination program for COVID.
Just a very quick word as well, David, on the political response to the school shooting in Minneapolis. I mean, sometimes the simple truth of these events is that what you hear the politicians say, you have heard many times over, and how awful that must be for the families involved to think that, yep, here comes another press conference, nothing's ever going to change.
Well, we've got an added ingredient in this one of a transgender shooter, so you can only imagine how the culture wars have kicked off in America about this. On the left, we've got the mayor of Minneapolis, a Democrat, saying anyone who tells you this isn't about weak gun policies is wrong, and it's all about tightening up who owns guns. And on the right, you've got anyone who tells you this isn't to do with mental health and the pressure that young and confusion that young people are feeling about gender identity is lying to you, and it's all about that. So we've got a fantastic row, as usual, about what's really to blame for this. And as usual, nothing will get done to make things better in America.
David, thank you for that. That's the US Assistant Editor, David Charter. And I mean, it's an eyebrow-raising story about our former Prime Minister's visit to the White House. It's front page of The Times today, and actually the photograph, and it's right that it should be the photograph on the front page of the newspaper today, is a mother trying to comfort a child after that shooting in Minneapolis.
Yeah, just horrific. Next on Times Radio, the only options for women over 60 on our screens. Well, I mean, you might be forgiven for believing you can only be a cuddly old biddy or a mad old crone, or possibly a mad old crone who likes a drink or three. Is that really the truth? We'll discuss in a moment. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio, 22 minutes past two.
PMQs Unpacked with Hugo Rifkin on Times Radio.
Recess is over and PMQs is back. So this Wednesday at midday, join us on Times Radio as we dive into the clashes in the House of Commons. I'll be joined by the ever-present Patrick Maguire, and this week also by Marcus Brigstocke, as we find out whether Keir Starmer enjoyed his holiday, any distractions, and whether Kemi Badenoch has figured out yet that all six questions can be about different things.
PMQs Unpacked every Wednesday afternoon on Times Radio.
Calling all little wildlife explorers. Playmobil is now in Happy Meal. Look, is that a seal? And a sea turtle? They've been around for millions of years, just like me. Which will your little ones discover? Some fun, some food, it's all inside this Happy Meal. Until the 14th of October from 11 a.m, Playmobil can prize toys only, subject to availability.
Summer's nearly over. It's time to get back to real life. Luckily, Cinch has got all the essentials sorted. And we're not talking about new textbooks. Let's see. The biggest range of cars to buy entirely online? Check. Free 90-day warranty? Sorted. And faff-free Cinch servicing at a Marshall store near you? Absolutely cinched it. Everything you need and not a pencil case in sight. Cinch it for yourself today. Visit cinch.co.uk. Comparison against equivalent retailers. Visit cinch.co.uk/range claim. Terms and exclusions apply.
People are tuning into radio more than ever. Advertise here and get your message heard by up to 6.5 million switched on listeners every week. Email radio at news.co.uk.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Just a quick WhatsApp from Amy, talking about this prospect from the budget. I mean, we're going to be endlessly speculating about what might be in the budget in a couple of weeks' time. But the idea today, and certainly lots of you are reading about this on thetimes.com, is that there could be a tax increase for landlords. And Amy says, does the government think landlords own property mortgage-free and it's just free money? Having a rental property, as I wanted to be aspirational and build something for my family, it's currently on the market and under offer, thank goodness. Stopping being a landlord as the rent isn't covering the mortgage. Does this tax take account of maintenance, mortgage costs? The tax is already paid. The risk of bad tenants? Yes, we've had one. There is always another side, of course. You can tell us what you think about anything we're talking about and indeed things we're not talking about. I mean, you never disappoint. 0333 003 2353 is the number. So women, older women, to be specific, on the screen, on stage. It's been tough, really, in fairness, for women of a so-called certain age. Downton Abbey's Elizabeth McGovern has had enough. She says she's finding it hard to find interesting roles outside the stereotypical biddy or the crone. In the paper today, the Times journalist Sarah Dightem has compiled a list, though, of some of her favourite roles played by women over 60. Sarah, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
Do you think Elizabeth McGovern has just she's just given in? And she, I mean, I know she's actually written a play for herself, hasn't she? And fair play to her for doing that. But you've actually drawn everyone's attention to a load of brilliant roles for, let's be honest, also incredibly gifted actresses over 60.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think I think there's kind of two strands to what Elizabeth McGovern is saying, and the first is the overall, in the entertainment industry, it is absolutely true that once women hit actually as young as 30, roles really start to drop off. If you look at the research, the graph is incredibly depressing because I think in the 18 to 35 age group, there's actually more roles for women than there are for men. But after that point, women just go whoomp, like just drops off so precipitously.
But those, sorry men, to interrupt, but those yeah. roles for younger women, are they central roles or are they?
They are much more likely to be the kind of love interest okay. type things as well. And that is also tied to the fact that Hollywood does still have a tendency to have age gap relationships as well. So Elizabeth McGovern is completely right. Once you get to her age, there are much fewer roles and much fewer interesting roles overall. But at the same time, I think she's indicative of a trend, which is that there are a lot of older women who are enormously talented and who have kind of taken the attitude that they're, you know, they don't really want to put up with this anymore. And they don't see why they should have to settle for sort of second rate roles and kind of biding their time until the final decline. So if you look at one of the people I put in this feature in the Times today is Julianne Moore, who has had an absolutely phenomenal run of dramatic roles. And given that she kind of comes out of Hollywood, which is savage, I would say, still remains savage towards women as they get older. She has, I mean, it helps that she's extremely talented, obviously. But she has, over the last few years, we've seen her in Pedro Almodovar's film, The Room Next Door, really fantastic drama. Seen her in Mary and George playing a kind of like ultimate sort of conniving mother in the court of James the First. And she's currently in Sirens, where she is this, and it seems to be really enjoying herself playing this incredibly evil yes. rich lady. And she's...
In the one about James, I mean, she effectively, am I right? She pimped out her son, didn't she?
She that did. Is That is what happens in that film, in that series, yeah. And she is wonderful in it, because it could be so easy for that to be the kind of, you know, wicked matriarch role. But because she's a great actress and because it's a great piece of writing, it's much more into the subtleties. You know, how can you be a woman and exercise power in these situations? Do you basically have to be a sociopath to function in a court? Probably, yes, it's yeah. true.
I mean, the worst example, I mean, this is such a shocker. Tell us about Rachel Griffiths.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I'm so pleased that I've managed to write about this, because I've been seething about this since 2002. So the 2002 movie Blow stars Johnny Depp as a drug dealer, but it also stars, Rachel Griffiths also has a role as Johnny Depp's mother, which is remarkable because she is, in fact, 5 years younger than him. And if you see the film, I mean, I think the filmmakers would probably defend themselves because they've got flashback segments. So she plays both. But it is absolutely preposterous. She's clearly too young to be Johnny Depp's mother. Yeah. And she's got this ludicrous caked on makeup. And it's a kind of double sexism, because it's both saying she at the time she was in her early 30s. Because it's both implying that in your early 30s, you're so old, you can only do the kind of aged mother roles. But also that a woman who was actually old enough to play Johnny Depp's mum would be sort of too repulsively ancient to put on screen.
Well, yes, I mean, it just can't be seen. People would be horrified. But really, it's not like we don't have agency here. We should make more of this. We should just not watch this stuff, or we should laugh at it. I mean, I could cope if there was an age gap romance in a film that I was otherwise enjoying, if it was acknowledged and laughed about. But that doesn't happen, does it? If it's an older man with a woman who's, let's say, 18 years younger than him, it's never referenced, or very rarely.
It is still, I mean, I think it has shifted a bit over the last couple of decades. So we don't see the kind of ludicrous Sean Connery and Catherine Zeta-Jones in Entrapment situation, which is almost as stupid as Rachel Griffiths in Blow, who's basically old enough to be her grandfather. They were sort of cavorting around.
Oh, Lord.
So we see less and less of that. But the other thing is that it just reflects an overall diminishing of visibility of stories about women, at stages in their lives when they are not being either the love interest or the, you know, the helpful nana. And the other really interesting thing that's come out of the research is the tendency, and this is something Elizabeth McGovern talked about as well, for older women's roles to really portray them as kind of decrepit, lonely, dependent, pathetic, burdensome, which is sort of completely ridiculous, because we know that women both live longer than men and live healthier than men. So if anything, it should be the men who are having to sort of, you know, sit in the armchairs and look pathetic.
We don't have a lot of time left, and I wish we did have more, Sarah, but it is also true that women on television as well, and I'm talking about really experienced, incredibly intelligent women who are newsreaders and senior reporters and journalists, there isn't one of them with, we were having a think in the office, there isn't a single one of them with silver hair or indeed grey hair. And the venerable older newsman is still very much with us.
Oh, that is an excellent point. It's something I don't really get into in the feature, but there is an element in which the kind of resurgence of the older woman is tied to, in some degrees, the fact that ageing is more and more possible to make invisible. So, you know, there is a lot of dyed hair. There's a lot of Botox. There's a fair amount of filler going on. And that is certainly helping to prolong women's careers as they look sort of acceptably youthful for longer.
Yes. Okay. Right.
But we don't have a leg to stand on that one, Jane.
No, I'm still, I was about to say, I've got my appointment in 10 days.
Yeah.
Nothing will stop me. Not for Botox.
We're working in what is not primarily a visual medium.
That's why I chose it.
But we're
rather
still
it chose
dying
me.
Our hair.
Yeah, of course.
So that's on, is that on us? Do we genuinely fear we'd lose our jobs if we were grey? I think they'd find, in my case, 10 first reasons.
Sarah, thank you very much. Let me just put this point. Matthew says, to be fair, I can see where Matthew's coming from. How awful that wealthy actresses who are older can't get first-rate roles, whilst most men over 60 who had conventional jobs can't get any work at all. Maybe women can. Ageism is absolutely rife. I think the jobs market for anybody over 60 is actually pretty tough. But thank you for that, Matthew. 0333 2353. What time is it, Fee? I find these time checks at this particular sort of time quite difficult.
Is it your eyesight? Is it fading, dear? It's 2:32. Have you ever been stung by an airline's baggage rules? The nation's favourite airline, Ryanair, don't all shout at me, is going to give staff bonuses for catching big bag cheats. First, the news with Martin Williams.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Russia's ambassador to the UK has been summoned by the Foreign Office after the second biggest airstrikes of the war hit Kyiv overnight. At least 18 people were killed. Ukraine says Moscow is choosing ballistics over the negotiating table. Chris York is news operations editor for the Kyiv Independent.
One of the buildings actually damaged in the attacks overnight belonged to the EU delegation here. There was also a British Council building damaged. Strikes across the city in five different sites. And in at least one of the sites on the left bank, they are still going through the rubble looking for survivors.
A man's been arrested over racist messages directed at England lioness Jess Carter. The defender revealed she'd stepped back from social media during the Euros after receiving a torrent of abuse online. Police have released a 59-year-old from Lancashire while inquiries continue. The government's arguing temporarily evicting asylum seekers from a hotel in Essex risks sparking further protests. Ministers and the hotel's owner are challenging a High Court ruling covering the Bell in Epping. The Treasury is reported to be considering a tax increase on landlords. It's thought Rachel Reeves could impose national insurance on rental income ahead of the autumn budget. And British cyclist Chris Froome has been airlifted to hospital after a crash during a training ride in France. The four-time Tour de France winner is in a stable condition after not sustaining any head injuries, but scans have confirmed a number of broken bones and Froome will have surgery this afternoon. Don't forget, you can set the Times News briefing as your news service on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
Fly direct to Texas and embark on a truly epic road trip adventure. Because there's no place on Earth like the Lone Star State. Explore miles of music, food, and culture from hill country to the Panhandle Plains. Experience cowboy grit, heritage, legendary hospitality, and those unbeatable cinematic sunsets in the great outdoors. Drive and discover your Texan road adventure at TexasFrontiers.com. Expand your frontiers.
It's a chilled summer's day. The twins are splashing in the paddling pool while Mrs. Thing puts her feet up. She's proper chuffed, having saved money on a British Gas boiler service. It's like an MOT for your boiler. Just £79, reduced from £109. Bliss! Well, it was nice while it lasted. British Gas. Taking care of things. Visit britishgas.co.uk to learn more and see full T's and C's. Sale ends 9th of September 2025. Offer available to new boiler service contract customers.
Daryl Morris wraps up the weekend's news and takes a look at the week ahead. Saturday and Sunday from 10pm. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Now, Nafisa has said, I honestly think if you get stung by a cost for your big bag now, it's totally your fault. It's not as if it's not mentioned. Well, that is very true. But I think, Nafisa, a lot of us are still travelling in hope that we can...
we've got this bargain flight, haven't we? Can't believe it.
Squidge our bag at home into the dimensions demanded by Ryanair. And then we find when we're actually there... the officialdom is going to come down on us. I suppose the point of the story, and we're going to talk about it in a couple of moments' time, is that it is being incentivised by the company for its employees to make sure that if you're one centimetre over, then they'll get a bit of a bonus and they'll also get your money because you have to pay more. Yeah. So, John Pienaar is here, takes over from us at 4 o'clock. You've got a busy slate, both in America and over here. Where will you start?
Well, I mean, look at the number keeps rising, of the numbers who were killed in the Russian strikes on Kyiv. And the EU are saying that Russia and Putin are mocking any idea of peace talks. And it's really hard, isn't it, to disagree with that logically, sensibly, in any way at all. I'm going to be talking to the former Prime Minister of Ukraine, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, and also to a former American ambassador in Ukraine. That's William B. Taylor. And just maybe trying to go through the question, what would it take for Donald Trump to actually get tough and stop saying, I'm going to make a decision in 2 weeks as to whether or not I'm going to be tough. Maybe it involves someone having another word in the ear of, or getting a message to Melania Trump, because that she seems to have some sort of purchase in this, in a maybe an inexplicable way, but still a curious one. And also, among other things, vaccinations. I mean, the sacking of the head of the vaccination agency in America by their new health secretary, RF Kennedy, is another example of something really quite extraordinary. It fits a pattern, but it's extraordinary in its own way. So I'm certainly going to be talking about that. And also, the story's just broken that here, not a single childhood vaccine in England last year met the target that's needed to ensure other diseases don't spread among our children. These are according to the latest figures. So, I mean, we'll see how far there's a common thread between those two things. Vaccine scepticism. Either way, kids are steadily being vaccinated in lower and lower numbers. And the dangers of that, most people would say, apart from hardened vaccine sceptics, are obvious.
Right. So that is an absolute fact now, that there aren't enough children vaccinated to provide what I think used to be called community protection.
Yes.
If you went above a certain percentage, then nobody would get infected.
Yeah. I mean, the World Health Organization say you need 95% of children to provide the herd immunity to protect children. And in all of the headings for various categories of illness, it's not that. And some are being steadily going backwards. So I'm going to be talking to an immunologist about a thing which will surely rightly worry a lot of people.
John, thank you very much. John starts at 4 o'clock here on Times Radio. So steady yourself against something firm. Do the tray table thing and squeeze in to your next door passenger. Ryanair is increasing the bonus given to airline staff who catch passengers carrying oversized luggage. Now, previously, Ryanair staff were given €1.50 to catch people with larger bags. That's now been increased to €2.50 per bag. And the sky really is the limit. The boss, Michael O'Leary, has also removed a monthly cap on the bonuses. Oh, busy, busy. Tom Saunders is the business reporter for The Times who's been covering the story, and he joins us now. Nafisa, one of our listeners, Tom, made a very good point that actually we talk about these restrictions on baggage a lot. So how many people are still unaware of what might happen to them if they try and get a big bag on a cheap airline?
I think a very small number of people wouldn't be aware of these rules. But I think at the same time, what generates so much interest in this story is there's still quite a few people who, despite knowing the rules, still try and sort of get by them at the same time, get around them even.
So we were discussing this in the office, and all of us have done this, where we've got a kind of squidgy bag, so not one of those rigid bags that you've bought specifically because it fits the dimensions, but you've got a bigger rucksack or something like that, and you look at the measurements and you get your ruler out and you think, yeah, well, I'll be able to squidge that in, so at some point it's going to fit the dimensions. But I think it is people like that who are going to get caught out, especially if this is a really well-incentivised policy for the airline. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's the idea behind the bonuses in the first place. But at the same time, Ryanair's own figures show that this is a very, at the moment at least, it's a really small percentage of people who are actually paying this fine. So it's 200,000 passengers last year of around 200 million that flew. So that's, well less than 1%.
OK, but if we then tot up the amount of money that is being paid out in bonuses to its staff, I'm going to shame myself with my immediate maths here, but if we're going €2.50 on £200,000, quick, help me out.
I'm enjoying this.
€500,000, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, but at the same time, yeah, €500,000 in bonuses, but obviously the fee for each bag is €75. So,
wow, okay, yeah. He still wins out. He does win.
Indeed, yeah.
Does there come a point at which we're all completely fed up with this, Tom, and we simply are prepared to pay for a different airline?
I wonder. I mean, Ryanair isn't the only airline in which you'll fly on where these bonuses exist. So Wizz Air and EasyJet, all of their ground staff, they're contracted to third parties, and some of these third parties offer their own bonuses. Both airlines say they have no oversight over, what these third parties are doing, what bonuses they're offering. But Ryanair isn't the only one. It's just probably the one that's been, quite frankly, most forthcoming recently in talking about it. And also, they are planning to raise their bonus as well.
It completely changes the relationship, though, doesn't it, between the passengers and the staff. So anyone who thought, OK, I'm a customer on this airline and the staff are there to very much help me with my journey to make it as easy as possible. And if they can, they're going to not bend the rules, but they're going to find a way to accommodate what I need. I mean, that's just gone, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I mean, I guess, you know, what Ryanair's position or Mike O'Leary's position would be. These are the rules, they're there for a reason, etc. You know, it's relatively simple. But I think, yeah, it does definitely change the relationship between the staff and those people using Ryanair.
Do you think that one day there will be a better way of getting everybody onto the plane, Tom? Because that is always given as a reason why they're so tight on the luggage, isn't it? Oh, yeah. You know, because we don't have enough space in the overhead lockers and then everyone's going to take time trying to find a different space and all that kind of stuff. Well, that's just rubbish, actually. The way that they get people onto planes is completely illogical. It often costs the airline quite a lot of money because you might get delayed and lose your slot. Why don't they have a rethink about that?
I mean, it's a good question. I honestly don't know. I mean, I know that Ryanair, for example, you know, they charge high fees for checked-in baggage. And they say, or at least Michael O'Leary says, that, you know, this is not primarily because they want to charge for luggage. They do it because they want to disincentivize people from checking in luggage because it makes things quicker. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there could be an easier way. I wouldn't know that.
Yeah, I think they just ought to go window first and then middle seat.
Maybe they should just ask you what you would do.
And then aisle seat.
But this not speedy boarding?
No, well, there are more people now not speedy boarding, aren't there? Speedy boarding has lost its speedy appeal.
Yeah, although I think with Ryanair, if you do priority boarding, you get an extra bag as well. So it's all sort of...
It's all tied in.
It's all tied in. I mean, to be honest, even just researching this article and trying to work out what each company did was very, very difficult.
Yeah, makes you want to stay home,
fees,
Tom.
It's so complex.
Yep, don't go abroad. Is there some kind of a wider regulation governing all of this anyway? I know we don't belong to the EU anymore, but we're often flying into the EU. So is there a kind of an overarching system that's being bucked?
Well, the EU is introducing regulations for enforcing a one free bag and a minimum size for each airline. And I think that is basically it in terms of regulation for baggage for the moment. So that has led Ryanair to increase the size of the one carry-on bag that it currently allows you to have for free.
Yeah. It is a minefield when you do the online purchase and then the online check-in. And I think, I don't know whether any of our listeners have found this too, there seems to be a slight naughtiness sometimes in the way that you travel through those online pages and allocate your baggage and are asked again and again. I find it almost impossible to work out whether or not I've paid the right amount of money for the right amount of luggage. And I think perhaps for the older generation, that would be even worse. Looking at you, kid.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. I was just looking at the price of Ryanair. I mean, they are invitingly, deliciously cheap.
Where could you go this evening?
I was just looking at the prices. Well, actually, I just want to say that Peter has sent us a short film of what looks like a really huge storm over Milan in Italy. Thank you for that, Peter. We'll have a look at that in a sec. But also, I thought I'll check on the price of a flight to Milan. £14.99. I mean, I'll take my entire family and everybody I've ever met. That sounds a great offer until you start to investigate.
£75.99 for a bag.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But it's not quite so simple.
Tom, lovely stuff. It's a very well-read article on The Times today, so it should be. That is Tom Saunders, business reporter for The Times. And Martina makes a point, and I think I'd really sympathise with you here. Martina says, as a lightweight woman, I'd be really angry about being fined for a few grams extra weight when I get squeezed into a seat next to an overweight big man overflowing into my space. And maybe there will come a day where you're paying per pound of flesh.
If we paid by height, you and I could travel the world.
We wouldn't need to work.
By Ryanair. For about £8. This is an interesting perspective, and I'm just going to chuck it out there from an anonymous WhatsApper who says, we're talking about age gap relationships earlier on, and this WhatsApper says, my wife is 10 years my junior, and she doesn't have a problem with that, but I feel like I haven't provided enough for her and her children from a previous relationship.
and now as well our one-year-old daughter. I'll be 50 in 3 years, and I wish I could do more to protect all their futures for when I'm not here. It's fine if you're a rich film star, but reality can kick you in the backside. I haven't thought about that, and that is something that I suppose you must, as the years go by, you must start to think about. Interesting. Thank you for that. Yes?
I've got a small message to give out, which I should have done before. If you're looking for that perfect holiday, you can now book with Times Holidays. Using partners trusted by the editorial team, our expert travel advisors can tailor-make and book your dream escape, whatever it may be. All trips are ABTA protected, so you know your booking is in safe hands. And if you want to find out a bit more about that and book something, it's thetimes.com/holidays.
Now, in the distant, is it the distance that I can hear a slightly dirty laugh? Or is it just next door? I think it's next door, and that probably means Jane Mulcairns has entered the broadcasting department. Yes, I can see her now. She's leering through the door. That means we're about to discuss the contents of this weekend's Times magazine. That's next here on Times Radio. It is 12 minutes to 3.
Jeff Norcott on Times Radio with Visit Dubai. Every Friday night from 7, Jeff Norcott takes you on an adventure through the latest global news, politics, philosophy, entertainment and the arts. Exploring the stories beyond the headlines and taking a light-hearted look at all the weekend's cultural highlights at home and abroad.
All that and more on Friday Night with Norcott.
Every Friday night from 7 on Times Radio with Visit Dubai. What's not to love? Start your journey at visitdubai.com.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
As a small business owner, you've got to be ready for the ups and the downs. Ready to think on your feet, ready to be rushed off your feet, ready to make the big decisions and make the tea. Two sugars in mind? Tough. Ready to be there for your customers whenever they need you. Well, ditto. Virgin Media Broadband's ready for anything business can throw at it. Yeah. It's business ready broadband. Search Virgin Media Business Broadband.
By river, ocean, and expedition, you can now explore all 7 continents with Viking. Start planning your journey today and discover for yourself why Viking was named Best River Cruise Operator and Best Luxury Ocean Cruise Operator at the 2024 Times and Sunday Times Travel Awards. Viking, exploring the world in comfort. Learn more at viking.com.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Hello, Jane.
Hello, Jane.
Right, let's move on. Jane Mulcairns is associate editor at the Times magazine. And every week at around this time, we have a little early probe into the contents of the Times magazine, which will be with you on Saturday morning. Or indeed, some of the fabulous stuff is already online.
It is. It's a truncated probe today. It's had the end taken off the probe because it's an embargoed magazine. So it's top secret, guys. So even, I can't even tell you what's
give
on
us
the cover.
Give us a clue.
It's a very famous person.
Okay, can you do a charade for us?
I don't know.
The cameras are on you.
I don't know how to answer.
All right, we'll leave that with you and we are going to come back to it, though. Let's start with the actual content.
Okay, I'm going to think about what the action would be. Yeah,
okay. Excellent. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Here's the stuff we are allowed to talk about, she says, slightly wearily.
Oh, come on, it's much more fun than what's on the cover.
Now, Jung Chang. Is it Jung or Jung Chang? I should know. She is the author of Wild Swans, which is a book I think a lot of people read.
About 14 million.
I mean, incredible, incredible book. So moving, so tough to read at times, about 3 generations of women in China. And she now lives in London. She lived in London for a long time. And she's written a new book, which is about what? And she's interviewed, I should say, in the magazine by Alice Thompson.
Yeah, it's a brilliant interview. It's been years since I read Wild Swans. Well, I mean, it was published 25 years ago. Yeah. So she's only just released the sequel. And I'd sort of forgotten some of the details of her extraordinary life, but it is about three generations away. And in the interview, Alice sort of you know, does recap some of that and some of the stuff that's in the new book that basically is her life since leaving China. But I'd forgotten the details of her sort of growing up under Mao and just the brutality of what she and her family endured. I mean, it's absolutely extraordinary.
Well, they had been pretty comfortable, hadn't they?
Yeah, they had been comfortable. And then when the Cultural Revolution happens and elitism was sort of outlawed, I mean, just really, really brutal. You know, her father was sort of paraded on a truck. Her mum was taken to denunciation meetings where they were spat at, and they were all separated and sent to camps in the Himalayas. This is extraordinary considering what an amazing writer is. She didn't have books for 10 years. There were no books that she could read when she was at this camp. It's amazing. And there's a really moving bit in the interview where she talks about coming to London on an exchange, a sort of, you know, language exchange sort of thing.
Things
got a little bit better when she was a teenager. So she'd gone to university. The university offered this sort of trip to London. And she talks about walking through Hyde Park. And she'd just never been to a green park before because all of the parks in China are these derelict wastelands. And she just used to walk across Hyde Park to the Science Museum and just lie down in Hyde Park for hours. And she said she still does that now, you know, 60-odd years on. She still loves walking through Hyde Park just because it's such an extraordinary, exotic thing for her, the green grass. It's a beautiful interview. I think the tricky point of the interview is that she says that she does worry that China is slipping back into authoritarianism again, you know, not to the same extent, because she says she thinks that they won't be able to close that door completely again, but that she is very, very concerned, and that she hasn't been back to China herself since 2019 because she's worried that she won't be able to leave again.
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, this is a very humbling piece because there's a photograph of her standing outside it's Clive House, which I think is in Croydon, I'm not sure, but it's a place where you go to get a British passport if you're lucky enough to get one. And I say lucky because she could not look any happier. It's a photograph from 1989 and she's standing outside this rather dull-looking building but clutching her British passport. And she is, she really challenges the notion that Britain's going to the dogs because she just says, you just don't know how lucky you are.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we should just say Fly Wild Swans is the sequel about moving to Britain in 78 and, you know, everything that's happened ever since.
Yeah, and her mum is still alive and in China.
Yeah.
And I know she rings her a lot, but probably has realised that she isn't going to be able to see her again. Her mum's 94. It's just really sad.
It's really sad.
So that's well worth your time over the course of the next couple of days. I hadn't heard of him. Dan Whitlam is Gen Z's poet laureate. Now, first of all, I took one look at him and leapt to some conclusions I shouldn't
Did
have leapt
Jane?
To. Yes.
What might they have been?
Well, you know, I just thought, well, he looks rather entitled. Then I find out he went to Dulwich College, and then I read on and I discover that he'd been the victim of a terrible attack.
Yeah, so when he was a student at Dulwich College, he and some friends were set upon by a gang of boys. And he intervened while one of his friends was being attacked, and he was stabbed through the lungs with a screwdriver. I mean, when he describes it, he thought he was being kicked in the back or punched in the back, but it's actually someone was stabbing him with a screwdriver. He, you know, went to hospital, did recover, was okay, but it took him a really, really long time psychologically and emotionally to recover from it. He'd always been a bit anxious, and he said that after that, he really was scared to go on the tube. His parents had to act as chaperones. He couldn't see his friends. He had flashbacks. He then took part in a restorative justice scheme where he met his attacker. And his dad had some doubts about it and sort of thought it was a bit woolly. But actually, it served them both tremendously.
Very brave thing
and incredibly brave things to do. And actually, that was sort of where his poetry started, was that he was trained to be an actor at Guildhall. And he used some of this experience of meeting his attacker to write a poem that was from both of their perspectives. And he said it was really useful because basically both of them had joined in to protect and help their friends. And it hadn't been that sort of anyone had intended him harm to begin with. But his poetry has done really, really well. And I will say you leapt to some conclusions when you saw him. I mean, part of the reason why he's in the magazine is because he has a very big following amongst female Gen Zs.
Yes. And I wasn't right to jump to conclusions, by the way, because having read it, I'm really impressed by his strength of character, actually.
And what about his poetry?
Well, I just don't know whether I can judge poetry. I've never really been certain. Have you read any of this?
I'm going to read
some. Yeah, I'll give that to you. It's obviously
Yeah, shall we? Let's, my colleague Fiona will read.
She's going to do a dramatic reading read for us.
There is a shorter one on the next page, if that helps.
What are you saying? You don't want to hear too much of me?
I think I'd like to hear a bit more of myself, but
I'll just do part of the longer one. It's a false thought to young minds, irony of being in your 20s, but feeling like you're running out of time. A line we've all heard in this life of downers and daffodils find our highs in ground down pills and cigarettes by the windowsill. Still trying to fill your future with what you should do, could do, what your mum and dad would like you to. When your mum and dad were sad as you, packed your bags because they frightened you. You stub out your cigarette and take another sip of tequila to kill the feeling that you should only go and think in the future. But it's a rumour, nothing truer. Wish I'd realised it sooner. It's always sunny above the clouds, so live right here for what's in front of you.
The poetry of Dan Whitlam, and you can read more about him in the Times magazine this weekend.
And if you want to Google some other pictures of him, other than the Times magazine ones, to make your own judgments, he did used to go out with Emma Mackey, who was in sex education.
I'm good with
You're good with these ones. But
there's
a picture of him at the Cannes Film Festival holding Emma Mackey's handbag. Right. And this was a tricky moment for him because he said it was very discombobulating because you left feeling that unless you're on a red carpet in Cannes, you're not successful. So it distorted what he thought success was. But now that he's had Fee Glover reading his poetry out live on Times Radio, I'm sure he's feeling much better about himself.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
You've written a very good piece in the magazine,
Jane. Thank you, Jane.
It's an interview with a former glamour model called Keely Hazel. Now, she is now in her 30s and has had a real reinvention.
Yeah, she's a really interesting proposition because she's a former Page Three girl who is very much a feminist, but she does say she doesn't believe that her glamour modelling was a feminist act, but that was the outcome of a very poor and kind of chaotic upbringing with lots of domestic violence, horrible boyfriends and lack of opportunities. She's written a memoir excellently titled Everyone See My Tits, Stories and Reflections from an Unlikely Feminist. Was that your memoir title when you were thinking of one?
Guess
of
I'll it,
Anyway, she makes the argument that if you come from a middle class or privileged background, you don't know
Everyone See My Cat. Well, it could have been worse.
Anyway, she says that those of us who come from sort of middle class upbringings, we don't realise the lack of opportunity that lots of women have and how much that and class can affect a woman's choices in life. It's a really interesting book. She's a really interesting interview. Anyway, she's reinvented herself. She's been in America. She's now a writer. There's a character named after her in Ted Lasso. And I very much enjoyed meeting her. She's very funny. Follow her on social media and read her book because she's a very entertaining and bright young woman.
Right, well said. Thank you very much indeed, Jane Mulkerins. And you can read all of that great content in the magazine and, as Jane said, some of it already online at thetimes.com.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
A very good afternoon to you all. It's 3 o'clock. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio. In the next hour of our programme, it's 4 years since the last British plane out of Kabul. We'll talk to a former Afghan politician who was lucky enough to escape the Taliban. Should teachers here be using AI to plan their lessons? And our big interview is with the art historian James Fox, whose new book is all about Britain's vanishing craftspeople. Let's get the news first with Martin Williams.
Good afternoon. The Prime Minister has accused Vladimir Putin of sabotaging hopes of peace after 18 people were killed in overnight strikes on Kyiv. A two-year-old is among the victims. Russia says it was targeting air bases. President Zelensky has called for the world to stop making excuses for the Russian president. Russia also fired two missiles into a British council building in the city in what Ukraine says was the second largest barrage of the war. Journalist Neil Hauer is following developments.
Over the past 3 or 4 months, the attacks have just been growing and growing in size. And yeah, for this to be the second largest one so far, I mean, that's involving over 400 or even 500 drones and cruise missiles here. So you know, another one of the heaviest nights that Kyiv's had to date.
A police officer from Stockton-on-Tees has pleaded guilty to 11 counts of sexual activity with a child. Nathan Henderson, who's 30, carried out the offences against the girl over a 12-month period. He also admitted perverting the course of justice and has been dismissed from his job at Cleveland Police. The government's considering proposals which would force landlords to pay national insurance on income from renting properties. The Treasury's trying to plug a £40 billion hole in public finances by targeting unearned income. Times chief political correspondent Aubrey Allegretti broke the story.
We've already had a backlash from landlords' associations who've been saying that this is going to ultimately affect tenants by pushing up rental costs, because what you'll just see is more landlords selling up and depressing the amount of supply there is in the rental market.
Racist hate crimes have reached record levels in Northern Ireland. Police figures show incidents have spiked, with over 1,000 more recorded this year than last. Charities say the issue's out of control and have called for a new anti-racism strategy. The operator of a helicopter which crashed on the Isle of Wight, killing three people, have described comments about the cause as inappropriate. The aircraft came down in a field near Shanklin on Monday during a flying lesson. One person survived and is being treated in hospital. Northumbria Helicopters says comments by the vehicle's manufacturer that 80% of similar crashes are caused by pilot error are inaccurate and deeply insensitive. And Will Smith has been accused of using AI to generate images of fans in a promotional video of his latest tour. The US actor and rapper has been attempting to rebuild his reputation after he slapped comedian Chris Rock on stage at an Oscars ceremony. Times technology correspondent Mark Selman has been investigating by speaking to experts in artificial intelligence who have also cast doubt on the video.
People started to look a little bit closer and all the faces were a bit blurry, the hands didn't have the right digits on it, and they started to call him out underneath the YouTube video. There's been no word from Will Smith. He and all his people have come back. But one of the weird things is, like, why would you do it?
And remember, the finest writers from The Times preview and review the week's football on The Game podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Good afternoon. Quite a few of you with tales to tell about Ryanair. Do you want to do that one from Corinna?
So Corinna flew Ryanair from Austria last week, paid for priority, which gives you a case and a smaller bag. I was travelling alone with my young son. I paid for four bags, including two cases. One case was 1 centimetre over the size guide. I was picked out of a line along with another woman. I paid an extra £75, was last on the plane despite paying for priority. I wouldn't have minded, but there were so many people with large bags and most of the flight was non-priority. Only two of us got picked out. I had to sit next to a man with two giant TK Maxx bags who sailed on without a second look. I was incensed. I felt I was on the verge of a heart attack. It was so unfair. Now, yes. Why do you think that anybody would go first for the completely Harris woman travelling with a young child?
Corinna, I'm sorry, because it does sound really miserable. It does make you wonder whether they might go for the people least likely to kick up a fuss if they're picked on for having a bag that is a tiny bit too large. Yeah. Anyway.
There are quite a few people saying, look, these are the rules. They display them very clearly. If you don't read them, then absolutely you do have to pay. And the reason why you get such a cheap ticket is because some people are paying to then have these, what we would have thought of as normal things, extra add-ons. Neil is one of those saying the ticket is a contract freely entered into. Conditions are clearly set out. So not everybody is sympathetic.
No, but we love hearing from you, whatever your point of view. Well, within reason. 0333 003 2353. That's the WhatsApp number that will get you straight through to the screens in front of us. Now, our big guest after 3:30, a very interesting man, James Fox, who is talking for about.
He's talking about the vanishing trades and lost arts of Britain's craft industry. We're going to go back in time with him. We're going to talk about dry stone walling. We're going to talk about blacksmiths' lives in the forge, and we're going to talk about where the fonts came from on many of our road signs and stuff like that.
OK, that's all fascinating, and you can hear all about it after 3:30. We're also talking about teachers and their increasing use of AI in the classroom before 4 o'clock. Today, though, marks 4 years since the last British flight out of Kabul. The Taliban regime has overseen human rights violations on an almost unimaginable scale, with women and girls and religious minorities systematically removed from society. Let's talk to Shukriya Barakzai, former Afghan politician and diplomat. Good afternoon to you. How are you?
Good afternoon. Just surviving.
Yes. I wonder how you feel on anniversaries like today. Do you regard today as significant?
Yeah, it is. Today has been marked as a fourth year of international forces, including Britain, left Afghanistan. It's remind me the day where the people of Afghanistan was stood with the international community at the 2001. And 2021 was completely different. It's a kind of mixed feeling. From one hand, we understand that democracy, human rights are valuable and international norms and principles. But on the other side is UK or world are feeling really safe when they hand over Afghanistan to the Taliban? You mentioned rightly about the situation of women in Afghanistan, which is we Afghan women, we call it gender apartheid.
Yeah.
The oppression of women and the banding people in their own society, the lack of legal documents to say what is the relation between state and citizen, and banding women from education, healthcare services, work, job, employment. These are not an easy sentence, even forcing them to cover their face while they are showing and reading the news as a broadcaster on the public private TV. And even recently, just yesterday, they had a press conference, live press conference broadcast. They didn't allow the voice of women to be on the public, on the state TV. So this is something which is, it's remind me, is everyone is happy what's going on in Afghanistan? Is everyone feel safe and secure? What about the war and terror? What about the extremists in the globe? What about the people that left behind? What about their yesterday colleagues? They stand and they work with them shoulder to shoulder to build. What about those promises?
Well, I know that you feel strongly that gender apartheid should in fact be codified into international law, because you're right, it is happening to the women and girls of Afghanistan. And I'm afraid you're also right that at the moment, the rest of the world doesn't particularly seem to care very much. How distressing is that for you?
It reminds me when Afghanistan was bent from one regime of ex-Soviet support regime, Dr. Najib was been shifted to Mujahideen. And later on, within a couple of years, the world saw and they pay again attention. Lifting over Afghanistan and leaving the way as it is, marginalizing is not the solution. The solution is codifying gender apartheid is the minimum request. It's just a legal procedure with the international norms and regulation laws, which is we like to be codified. This is the minimum thing that countries and state could stand with us. But more than that, is that fair? What is their answer for those people they send and they put their life at risk from Britain that, okay, fight for women's rights, human rights, democracy, safety and security for your own country? Is Britain is feeling safe? Is Europe is safe now? They're not feeling any threatening? Then why yesterday the Security Council was really paying a report and saying the ISIS-K is a big and greater threat. Al-Qaeda is the name of terrorist group as Taliban. So this is something when we are talking about Afghanistan now, unfortunately, become more safe land for all extremists and terrorist groups to be active.
Now, I don't know whether you know, and there's no reason for you to know. I know you don't live in the UK, but there's been a lot of discussion in this country because an opposition party here, Reform, has been talking this week about a plan they have to deport Afghan asylum seekers from the UK. And they say they think it would be reasonable to pay the Taliban to return these people to Afghanistan. Do you think that's wise?
This is very worrying. Afghanistan is not safe for safe deportation. Afghanistan today means sending them, or Afghan means like if we do today, send them straight and to the prostitutions. And for women and girls, life without rights and freedom. This is what a simple word, if I could say. Meanwhile, to be honest, Britain don't need to solve, I understand, the problem of the world. But Britain need to stood what they promised. I think it is not only the matter of reputation. Well, we are talking about the rule of law, international obligations when it comes United Kingdom to keep their promises.
Well, I'm sure I don't want to interrupt you, but I'm anxious just to ask what you know about current conditions there. I'm sure you still have friends and family in Afghanistan. Are you able to talk to them?
Yes, the phone they are talking to me, they are leaving at home. They are not taking with them outside because even simple, their cell phones are not safe. People are being punished by speaking with me or people like me. I was representing the people of Afghanistan in the parliament and also as an ambassador outside of Afghanistan, a women's rights activist. But it doesn't mean that we are not in contact. Afghanistan is not safe. I'm sure you heard, and even the opposition, even Mr. Farage, clearly understand the situation and circumstances of Afghanistan. Is that simple enough to send people back to the hill? Send them to be killed? When this is international convention says, when they're feeling asylum seeker, when they're feeling or they are threatening or their life is under threat in their country, they shouldn't send. So we have to obey international rules and regulation. It's not something like what opposition says. It's really sad for me that even Taliban announced that they like to go and deal with Farage rather than the United Kingdom.
I don't want to interrupt. We've got a question for you from a listener who's really interested in what you've been saying. And she just wants to know, what about ordinary men in Afghanistan? Are they not fighting against the gender apartheid of the Taliban? And I think, to be fair, I think it's a good question. I think a lot of us just wonder whether the men have given up or do they in some ways benefit from the fact that the women in their lives, the girls in their families, cannot go out, cannot do anything, are confined to the home.
It's a kind of a boat. From one hand, according to the Taliban rules, men, a family member, must be receiving the position of women with the non-governmental organization. So it means women cannot be a director. They must hand over that job to their male member of family or any man that they could trust. So it means on the other side, when we are talking about people of Afghanistan, men and women, that's why Taliban are lacking legitimacy inside of Afghanistan, because men and women in Afghanistan, they are not legitimizing Taliban and they are not recognizing them as a state. So people are asking me every day when the change will come, when the things will go better. And men, when you're talking, how I can call them when they don't have the rights or the choice, which kind of dress they like to wear and how long their hair should be and how they should dress up while they are forcing in the public. If they are not really applying what is the Taliban code of conduct for them with the religious police, according to Taliban, because they like men to have a long beard, wearing very traditional clothes, and to do whatever they likes to do. Sometimes even they force them to go and pray rather than 5 times a day, 10 times, because this is also a kind of force. Men is also not being safe. Right. And also we shouldn't undermine that a list of men was being issued where Taliban are after them. Even those force attorneys comes from Iran, but automatically with their bio data, they find their previous job and they were being disappeared. So these are kind of the trend we are looking. It doesn't mean Afghan men is not keen for gender apartheid to be recognized. Inside of Afghanistan, we do have a male colleague that they are standing with women. They are supporting. When we are talking about men support, when today some of the houses are turning and turned to be a homeschool, this is house belong to men and women. When today online school and education is going on, this is with the cooperation of men and women or some international organization or local organization that working underground. It's also with the support of men and women. But largely, yes, we cannot want men to stand with us while we are raising our voice in the streets of Afghanistan.
Thank you very much. I'm so sorry to interrupt. We just want to move on, but thank you very much indeed for your time. Shukriya Barakzai, who is a former Afghan parliamentarian and diplomat. The Labour MP, Calvin Bailey, can talk to us too, a former RAF commander who helped with the Afghan evacuation. It must be rather difficult, Mr. Bailey, for you to listen to conversations like that, and you realise that, frankly, conditions for people in Afghanistan are truly, truly wretched.
Yes. It's incredibly emotional listening to that. And it should put in context some of the discussion that we have about asylum. Whilst the numbers of asylum seekers from certain countries like Afghanistan are higher than they are from elsewhere, there is perhaps good reason for why they are. And that's what we were hearing. And we shouldn't confuse the failings of our immigration system with the legitimacy of people seeking asylum from countries like Afghanistan.
It really is dispiriting for, I think, many people to hear politicians talk in a, not exactly in a dismissive way, but, well, actually, frankly, in quite a dismissive way about simply getting rid of these people from our streets, implying that they all represent a great danger to us, and sending them back to a country that is clearly not a place any of us would like to live. How do you tackle that as a proposal from the perspective of some? I'm sure you have constituents who are concerned about illegal immigration.
Absolutely. And I think we all are. But I think what's important is to separate the two issues. The first is a failure of government. It's a failure of the previous government's ability to process asylum seekers, to have to not have agreements in place with partner countries that would help us deal with and address immigration issues, and to separate that from areas where there are real systemic problems like Afghanistan and Sudan, you know, are the two big areas where we're seeing immigration, because they have really quite significant national problems. And one is Afghanistan is somewhere that we chose to intervene and to try and engage and bring about a change in their daily existence. And as a result of our failed foreign policy, we've got the situation that we were just hearing about from your previous speaker.
Yeah, I mean, there is no doubt that our intervention in Afghanistan was an abject failure and has made things significantly worse.
Well, I think more that the way the intervention ended, you know, there were some failures over the course of 14 years, but the way the intervention ended has left Afghanistan in a situation that will take some time to recover, and we're seeing that both visibly in the publicly recognised migration numbers, but also those people that we just failed, that were fighting alongside us, that the previous government refused to recognise their contribution to our peace and security. So again, there are two issues at play here, but fundamentally, a lot of the Afghan problem is a result of a failure of foreign policy.
Thank you very much. That's Labour MP Calvin Bailey, a former RAF commander who helped with the Afghanistan evacuation. Of course, it's also just got to be said that many of the British forces who went and fought in Afghanistan were tremendously courageous, and the situation there must have been absolutely brutal for them, and that's definitely something we need to acknowledge. What's that comment from Mike V? Have you seen that?
So Mike says, as a veteran, I'm absolutely fed up with people like this lady and actually some of our press being disrespectful to the British forces and coalition forces on what we did in Afghanistan. We got the country to the point where they were able to defend themselves and continue to have a free and democratic country. But it was the Afghans that capitulated and failed the women and children of the country, not the UK, not the US, not British forces, but Afghans that are failing Afghanistan and failing in their civic duty. It isn't the job of the UK to sort all of the world's problems. And another one from Susie, who says, I think some of these speakers don't have Afghanistan in perspective. The whole of Afghanistan, I know, is not as repressed as we're made to think. I have two family friends from Afghanistan who on a regular basis throughout the year travel to and from the country for family functions, family weddings. Even one of the young men in the family recently went back to Afghanistan to get married to an Indian girl. And now they're both living here, but they are regularly travelling to visit family. So I can't believe that you can assume the whole of Afghanistan is a terrible place to live. Thank you.
Well, Times Radio's brand new political editor is Anna Mihailova, and she joins us from next week. Great time for that job to start for anybody, I would imagine. She's going to be bringing us all the latest insight and analysis from Westminster as MPs get back to work after their very long summer break. And, of course, we head into the party conference season as well. So Anna Mihailova's sharp analysis will be all over Times Radio, all over it from Monday.
And I think we're talking to, aren't we, which day next week?
I don't know, but it will be very soon in the week.
One of the days next week.
One ending, of those days.
Ending in day, we will be talking to the lady herself. Let's do some more news from this country now. Almost half of teachers now use artificial intelligence at least once a month. Annual research from the National Literary Trust surveyed 3,000 teachers and 6,000 students and found that the use of AI has soared in schools over the course of the last year. We're joined now by Gráinne Hallahan, a former teacher who now works at TeacherTap, which uses insights from teacher surveys to publish tools and research on teaching. A very good afternoon from us. Can you just fill us in a little bit about what teachers are using AI for? Could you give us some examples?
Hello, thanks for having us. So yes, we ask our teachers all the time about their use of AI and what they're using it for. And it's a real range of things. So we see in primary schools that a lot of teachers are using it to generate like example answers. If they're doing like story work with children, like to come up with writing frames, sometimes to adjust the text to make it more difficult or more accessible for students if they've got children with different abilities in their class. And another thing that we've asked a lot about last year was report writing, whether or not they were using AI to write their school reports about their students. And we heard that, you know, a small number of schools were banning it altogether. So 5% had banned AI, but 53% had no policy at all. And then about a third were allowed to use it. So yeah, report writing was one of the ones we were quite surprised about how prevalent it was.
Do you think we're in a place at the moment, Gráinne, where we're just automatically making an assumption that any use of AI in schools is bad, either by the pupils or by the teachers? It's just going to be bad. But actually, there's a nuance here that we need to understand. It could be extremely helpful, surely, if you've got a supply teacher who might not be completely across the brief but is called in at a moment's notice. If you've got part of a subject absolutely nailed down, but you just need some suggestions for essay titles, stuff like that isn't necessarily bad, 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 is it?
So this is like any tool in the wrong hands without expertise. It can be used badly. The example you just gave about a supply teacher who's using it, you know, to fill in gaps. We actually had a teacher write in and tell us about this, that was happening for them. They were teaching outside of their subject. They've been asked to pick up a history class, and they were using AI to generate the starters for the lesson. So that each start of the lesson began with like checking these facts and a quick little quiz for the students. But the problem was they didn't realise the questions that they were asking the students had incorrect answers to them, because they weren't a specialist. They weren't able to check it over. That actually they found that they'd taught all these things incorrectly and had to go and undo it and redo it all. So sometimes it can be really useful, but unless somebody's checking it and somebody with the expertise there say, oh, hold on, nope, that's the wrong battle, or you've mixed up your King Charles's there, then it can be, you know, really difficult and really problematic.
What do you think the best way of trying to police this is? Because you can't constantly be marking the teacher's marking, can you?
You can't police it. I think we've just got to look at developing really good AI tools for teachers to use in schools and make sure that they're affordable and that schools are using them. It's only as good as the tool that you're using, and making sure that somebody is checking it. But like anything, like using a search engine, like using a textbook, you turn to the wrong page, you read the wrong passage, you skim it too quickly. It's like anything. It's not perfect, but we definitely need to rein in some of the policies, making sure that those half of schools that don't have a policy about whether or not you can use ChatGPT or an AI tool to write your school report, I'd like to think that all schools would have a policy on this.
Right.
You know, teachers are using it. We know they're using it. Leaders in schools need to make sure that they've got their policies locked down, and it's really clear that every single teacher in that school knows what they can and can't use it for.
It's also very important, isn't it, for the pupils to know what's available to them and what's available to their teachers. Otherwise, you can conceivably see quite an area of conflict.
Absolutely. I think you've touched upon the really important part of all of this is like, what are we teaching students to do? Are we teaching them to use AI correctly and, you know, ethically and well and to the best advantage for their subject? If you think about, let's say secondary school, each subject would have an advantage and disadvantage of using AI in different ways. It's very nuanced, isn't it? Each subject would lend itself in a different way. Something that we thought was interesting is we asked our teachers about, if they were students, would they use AI to cheat in their lessons? And 1 in 5 said that if they were a student today, they would be using AI even if told not to, which, you know, did really tickle me. But we've also seen a massive increase in teachers saying that students are using AI to cheat in their lessons, that like they've been told not to use it, but they're using it anyway. When we first asked this in 2023, only 8%, like a tiny number, were saying this is a problem. When we asked most recently, it's jumped up to 28%.
I mean, it's so hard to see what the future of this is going to be, Grania, because you can completely understand that if you've spent your entire childhood knowing that that technology is available to you, becoming very astute at how to use it, how to show when you're using it and when you're not using it, I think, aren't we just being naive to think that we can always have a decent barrier between us and the product?
Absolutely. And, you know, I've got an 11-year-old, and she was using it to come up with a packing list for her holiday. Like she'd put in where she was going, and it told her what temperature it was going to be, what she should pack, how much she needed. And I was quite struck by what a clever way of doing.
I just think it's a very good idea. Yep. So, but it's such a good example, actually, because it's stuff like that where it's practical and it's helpful. And, you know, there's going to be a whole generation of kids who don't necessarily see these things as being the enemy. We see them as the enemy at the moment, don't we?
And a really interesting thing, I think you'll like this. We're hearing a lot from teachers who teach students with ADHD, or they might have ADHD themselves, and are saying they're using very particular tools, using their AI, like AI-enabled tools, to help them manage their time and schedule their tasks and making sure they're prioritising. And somebody wrote in recently and said, this is life-changing. Like, it's completely changed the way that I work. It's really helped me manage my workload. It's great. And I think in those examples, if we can make people who've previously felt overwhelmed by, you know, a really complicated task, make it feel, do you know what? I can do this. This is more accessible for teachers, for students, for everyone. That's fantastic. That's great. But like we've said before, all of this needs to be done like together, like we need to think about this as like a big plan, not just people off going and doing their own things and possibly getting themselves into difficult situations where they're putting in protected information into open AI. And, you know, it's, we don't want that to happen, but we want people to be able to use these tools well and in sensible ways.
Sure. What fascinating stuff. Thank you very much indeed. Gráinne Hallahan is a former teacher now working at Teacher Tap. And just to go right back to her original answer to the question, it's that point, isn't it, Jane, that if you've got the wrong battle being attributed to the wrong date and you start teaching that in class, then you're breeding that kind of wrong answer, aren't you? You're sending it out into the world.
Out it goes.
So maybe 33 people say that the, what should we say, the Battle of Hastings was in 1972.
Yeah, exactly.
And then eventually that becomes the definitive answer. So that's what you've got to be careful of.
Now, I know that Scottish schools have already gone back, haven't they? But it is back to school time next week in much of the country. Kevin just says, when you're talking about AI in schools, please don't just talk about teachers. The vast majority of staff in schools are support staff who are keeping the school open and running. AI can be an indispensable tool. For example, a school business manager who is always overworked and has 5 risk assessments to write and no time to do it. That's from Kevin, and I think he might be, I'm just guessing, he might be a school business manager.
I think he might be Kevin up against it from Stroud.
Yeah, but good luck to everybody preparing for the back to school excitement of next week. Now, next, our big interview is coming your way with the art historian James Fox, and he's focusing on Britain's vanishing craftspeople. That's next here on Times Radio, just after 3:30. Here are the headlines. Martin Williams.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you and good afternoon. The Prime Minister has condemned what he calls senseless Russian strikes on Ukraine that have killed at least 18 people, 3 of them children. The Russian ambassador to the UK has been summoned after the mass drone and missile attack on the centre of Kyiv damaged a British council building. This woman's trying to find her mother in the rubble of another building targeted in the strike.
I went down to the shelter and just 2 minutes later there was an explosion and everything started to collapse. We tried to go outside, but another blast hit. I realised there was nothing I could do to help my mum. There was an identification attempt, but she isn't there, and so far they haven't found her.
A man's been arrested by police investigating online abuse sent to England lioness Jess Carter. The defender announced she'd taken a break from social media during the Euros championships. A 59-year-old from Lancashire has been released under investigation. British cyclist Chris Froome has been flown to hospital after a crash during a training ride in France. The 4-time Tour de France winner is in a stable condition with broken bones. Racist hate crimes have reached record levels in Northern Ireland. Over 1,000 more incidents have been recorded this year than last. Sports car maker Lotus is cutting up to 550 jobs. 40% of the workforce will go at its plant in Norfolk in a restructuring programme. And Prince Harry is going to return to the UK on the 3rd anniversary of Queen Elizabeth's death next month. The Duke of Sussex will attend a charity awards ceremony, but there's no word on whether he'll meet the King. And don't forget, you can set the Times News briefing as your flash briefing on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
At Viking, we believe travel should be more than just a trip. It should be a doorway to cultural insight and personal enrichment. Start planning your river, ocean, or expedition journey today and discover why Viking was named Best River Cruise Operator and Best Luxury Ocean Cruise Operator at the 2024 Times and Sunday Times Travel Awards. Learn more at viking.com.
It's a chilled summer's day. The twins are splashing in the paddling pool while Mrs. Thing puts her feet up. She's proper chuffed, having saved money on a British Gas boiler service. It's like an MOT for your boiler. Just £79, reduced from £109. Bliss! Well, it was nice while it lasted. British Gas. Taking care of things. Visit britishgas.co.uk to learn more and see full T's and C's. Sale ends 9th of September 2025. Offer available to new boiler service contract customers.
When you're growing a small business, you need someone who understands the ins and outs. And whether you're a tailor or an accountant, you need the tools to succeed.
With an HSBC small business banking account, you'll have free accounting tools and access to our business specialists, virtually or in person. Because whatever your small business looks like, we're with you all the way. Search HSBC small business banking account to get started. Subject to application, eligibility, credit check and T's and C's. Visit hsbc.co.uk for details.
Get the day's politics, business and sport every weekday in Breakfast from 6:30 a.m. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Good afternoon, and James Fox is coming very soon talking about Britain's vanishing craftspeople. Just want to mention first that you'll know that President Trump announced on Truth Social this week that he'd fired Federal Reserve Board member Lisa Cook. Well, let's be honest, most of us had no idea who she was. But it turns out her sacking could have quite an impact. This move is seen as part of the continued politicisation of the Fed at the US independent central bank. And some economists fear it could be the start of a journey towards economic meltdown in America with global repercussions, inevitably. In today's The Story podcast, Manveen Rana has been speaking to Maureen Khan, the economics editor at The Times, about what could happen if Jerome Powell, the chair of the Fed, also leaves the board.
So by the middle of next year, you could get a sense in which the institution has just become very politicised, almost by stealth overnight. And now we're in a world where he's got control of the Federal Reserve and all of his lackeys are in the Federal Reserve and they're just determined to cut interest rates because intellectually that's the they think is the right thing to do. So yes, I think stagflation, for the first time seriously, we really should be thinking about this phenomenon because there is a huge question about whether US monetary policy is now truly independent.
That is the voice of Maureen Khan, economics editor at The Times. You can hear more from her on The Story podcast, one story told in depth every day, and it's available for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, Britain was once a craft land, a nation of workshops and studios, masters and apprentices, a society grounded in the act of making things by hand. For much of our history, craft wasn't a quaint pastime, but an engine of social and economic life, and without it, the country would have quite literally ground to a halt. Well, those are just some of the words in the latest book from James Fox, which is called Craftland. James is Director of Studies in History of Art at Emmanuel College, Cambridge. He's a very, very big brain, everybody. And he's got fans out there. Anne in Norfolk, James, is delighted that you're on because the work that you've done on colour has changed her life. And Paul in Faversham says, I love James Fox's A Very British Renaissance. Thank him for introducing Thomas Tallis to me via Bob Dylan. It's a sentence that's meaning nothing to me, but I'm hoping it's meaning something to you. A truly remarkable piece of television. You're very welcome on our programme.
Thank you for having me.
Take us to the workshop that you found yourself in that's right at the start of this latest book.
Yes, so one of the things I do, my many jobs that I have, is I'm creative director of an art charity up in the Scottish Borders. And as soon as I started working there, all these people started to tell me, you've got to go to this building. It's a secret place in a nearby village. Anyway, so I became determined to get inside this building, and it was extremely difficult to do. I had to speak to the stone carver who lived next door. She then spoke to the gamekeeper, who spoke to the bookbinder, who eventually got me in touch with a landowner who lived a long way away. And after, honestly, months and months of negotiation, he managed to get the key to me. So one day, it was spring, I think, of last year, I opened this old building and I walked inside, and inside was this blacksmith's workshop that was completely untouched in 60 years. Extraordinary. All the tools were still there. There was a half-smoked cigarette on the workbench. There was an apron hanging by the door. The last blacksmith in this village, after centuries and centuries of a blacksmith being there, had left 60 years ago, and no one had been in until me. So that was a really exciting moment that really for me captured this idea of these trades disappearing, the kind of work and the kind of businesses that thrive in this country moving on.
Do you know who that last blacksmith was?
His name was D.T. Patterson, and he tried for a while to become a handyman, and he experimented with various kind of wind turbines and things for a few years, but nothing really worked out. And he was, of course, a trained blacksmith, and all of his equipment is still there, all the wheelwright, the farrier machinery and everything. But yes, he tried to move with the times, as many craftspeople did, as society changed, and he just couldn't quite manage it.
How many blacksmiths are left in the country?
they're probably, I mean, it's one of the less endangered trades. So there's some trades and crafts that are honestly critically endangered. They're sustained by one or two people. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of blacksmiths. It's one of the few trades that's still viable. But I went to see many crafts where, honestly, it was, you know, it was one person. And if that one person gets ill or dies or the business folds, that's the end of a tradition that goes back for centuries and centuries.
I found your book so evocative to read, but I was very aware all of the time that you're trying to make sure that the reader doesn't kind of gorge on nostalgia, because actually it's important not to have these rose-tinted spectacles. Yeah. A blacksmith's life would have been hard.
Yeah.
It's not some kind of quaint pastime, as you so rightly point out.
No, and craft today is not easy. I mean, a lot of people, I remember that was speaking to a rush weaver in Bedfordshire. I grew up in Bedfordshire. I never thought that Bedfordshire would be home to this extraordinary craft. And she said, there's nothing more annoying than when someone says to me, is your craft very mindful and relaxing? It's bloody hard work, she said, because, you know, because professional craftspeople are having to run businesses. And they have all the stress that everyone else has of running businesses and keeping, you know, making a living, as well as obviously the physical demands of the work as well. So it's you know, we shouldn't be nostalgic about it. It's proper work.
Yeah. It's an interesting point to raise, though, isn't it, about the mindful mentality and the wellness woo-woo experience that is quite often accompanied by an invitation to take yourself back in time to some basket weaving or candle making. And it's not necessarily a bad thing if it's keeping those things alive, is it?
I think we have to make a distinction between tradespeople, the professional craftspeople who are trying to make a living from their work, and people who are doing craft as a hobby. Now, I'm not critical at all of people doing craft as a hobby. It's an amazing thing that has enormous personal and social benefits. And we are undergoing a sort of craft revival at the moment. You know, a lot of people took up crafting in various forms during that first lockdown and COVID. The numbers of people attending quilting workshops and green woodworking workshops is going up all the time. And it's enormously beneficial to people in their lives.
There's an astonishing table that you have put quite early on in the book about the decline in some of the rural crafts and trades. So just as a couple of examples, butchers in 1901, 109,000 in 1951, just 11,000. Yeah. Milliners in 1901, 380,000, and in 1951, just 7,000. I mean, this is enormous, actually. Does it tell us a story about previous generations taking the brunt of the impact of decline?
Yes, I think the decline has been going for some time. I think one of the things that's so remarkable is that every village, every town, every city, even the tiniest little hamlet, was a community of craftspeople. A couple of hundred years ago, there would have been blacksmiths and wheelwrights and thatchers and bootmakers. There would have been milliners. There would have been tailors. There would have been masons in every tiny little village. So there was so much skill and so much knowledge and so much handiness taking place in every community. And that, of course, has changed. Times have changed. We are now in situations where, for instance, bell founders, there used to be a bell foundry, you know, bells were being made all over the country. There's now one left. Tanneries, there used to be tanneries all over the country. I mean, there were 600 in Bermondsey alone. There's
Can
now
just
one
remind
left.
Us what a tannery did.
A tannery was a business that created leather. So they tanned animal skins to turn them into leather. So there used to be one in virtually every village. They were nearly always on the outskirts of the place because they stank. Yeah. Absolutely stank. There's now just one left. It's in Devon. It's an incredible place. There's a town in Devon called Collerton. And this town, at the edge of the town, you've got a meadow. This meadow looks very boring if you don't know what it is. But on one side of this meadow, there's the only working tannery, oak bark tannery in the country, that's been there operating continuously since Roman times. And on the other side of the meadow, honestly just 100 metres away, you can hear the tools from one to the other. There's one of the country's only wheelwrights. And they have been wheelwrights since the 15th century, since the 14th century, in fact. So the fact that those two trades could exist and can be doing well in one little place, I think it gives you a sense of what every community would have been like some time ago.
Let's talk more about the specifics of some of these industries, because it's so fascinating. I'd never even heard, James, of letter cutting. So what is this?
Letter cutting is this amazing trade that is essentially the carving of inscriptions into durable materials, into stone. The amazing thing about this is that it's obviously an extremely difficult thing to do. Years and years and years of practice.
So we're not talking stonemasons here.
It's a particular brand of masonry in which you're carving inscriptions. And you might think, what's letter cutting got to do with my life? But if you actually leave your house and you walk through the street, you will see their work absolutely everywhere. Every front of buildings, on the sides of streets, carved into everything, you'll see beautiful inscriptions carved by anonymous masons and letter cutters years gone by. And of course, we think letter cutting has nothing to do with us. But what's the first thing we do when someone we love dies? What do? We commission a gravestone that's got out the names of our loved one carved into it. So it is still something that's meaningful to us.
Very much so. And you really made me think, because the letter cutting that we see around us is exquisite, as you've said. I've never in my life seen someone who's made a cock-up doing their letter cutting, or a kind of, you know, really bad one. Actually, the level of craft and artistic merit is so high, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, I have seen, I was up in Norfolk a few months ago, and I saw an inscription that did have several errors.
of course,
a lot of those letter cutters in the past would have been illiterate, so they were working from what they were given. But the person I speak to in this book is this extraordinary letter cutter called Leda Cardozo. They're the greatest letter cutting business in the country. They're based in Cambridge. And I asked her, she's been doing it for 50, 60 years. I said, how many errors have you made? And she said one.
Wow.
And it was in a Hebrew character, so she obviously wasn't familiar with the alphabet.
Kate is just asking about the link between crafts and surnames.
Yes.
And we were talking about Wheelwrights. There is that's the surname, isn't it? Wheelwright.
Yeah, I mean, if your surname is Smith or Wright or Mason or Cooper or Taylor or Chandler or Dexter or Glover or Challoner or Kellogg, for instance.
What's a Kellogg?
Kill Hog, pork butcher. Then you descend from one of these craftspeople.
Wow.
They are written, that craft is still very much part of our language. You know, if textiles, for instance, I've got a passage in the book where we talk about the enormous impact of textiles on our language, whether you cotton onto something or you're cut from the same cloth. These things are still part of us, even if we don't realise they are.
Can we also talk about George Daniels and Roger Smith?
Oh, yes. I mean, there are so many great stories in this book that I've been so honoured to tell. And perhaps the most exciting story for me was the story of this young boy called Roger Smith. He was born in Bolton in the 1970s, not very good at school, not very academic, but he loved making models. And one day he was bought by his father a book about watchmaking by a man called George Daniels, who was one of the great watchmakers of his generation. And Roger, who was only 16 or 17 at the time, decided he was going to make a watch from scratch. Now, this sounds like a pretty, maybe a relatively straightforward thing to do. Hardly anyone
not
had...
Not to me, it doesn't.
And not to me either. But hardly anyone had done this in the whole history of watchmaking. In fact, there were 34 different professions involved in making every single watch. So he decided to do this. He turns his parents' garage into a little workshop and spends a year and a half making this watch by hand, every single piece by hand. He travels to meet George Daniels to show him what he's made. George Daniels is relatively elderly at this time. He looks at the watch. He says, it's useless. You have to start again. So Roger goes back home to Bolton and he spends the next 5 years making the second watch, every single part by hand, day and night, 7 days a week, making this watch. And then after 5 years, it's now 6.5 years after he first got that book, he returns to George Daniels. George Daniels looks at the watch very closely and then says to him, congratulations, you're a watchmaker. And that watch 2 years ago sold for $4.9 million.
Wow.
And Roger is now one of the world's great watchmakers. You know, Britain used to be the greatest watchmaking country in the world. We made half of all watches in 1800. The industry completely collapsed in the 19th century. But now Roger, who's based on the Isle of Man, is spearheading this great revival in British watchmaking. And watches in Britain are finally being taken seriously around the world now.
I think the watch tells a really interesting story, James, doesn't it? Because it's about consumers turning away from something because a technological replacement comes along.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've got a mobile phone. Most of us have got a mobile phone now. That's how we tell the time. I don't really need a wristwatch. So to someone like you who studies all of this, do we need to find a solution to those kind of either-or problems? Or do we just have to accept an evolution has happened that's just we've chosen this direction.
I'm not some rampant traditionalist who think we should all be living like we're peasants in the 18th century. I don't believe that craft should be kept alive just for the sake of it. I think craft has to prove it's respond to the needs of society. Crafts emerged in the first place because they were needed. And I think crafts can still do that today. And you know, Roger Smith is selling his watches at £300,000 plus. And there is a market for them because he's showing that there is still a need for handmade things. And I would say it's not just a need. I think it's a deep urge within us to own things that are made by hand. It's meaningful when you own something and you hold something that a human being has made slowly, carefully, lovingly, with dedication. There is something meaningful about that. Mm. And it's something generally, if we get something like that rather than something cheap from a supermarket, we're more likely to look after it. We're more likely to care for it and pass it on as an heirloom.
Are crafts still being developed? Are there new ones?
There are lots of new crafts. I don't believe that craft is solely traditional. I think there is craft, in fact, in all kinds of activities and all kinds of ways of going about things. I think there's a craft to graphic design. There's a craft to coding. There's a craft to being an artisan baker. There's a craft to being a tattoo artist. I think there's a craft in, you know, anyone who's using their body and their embodied skill to make something well. I think that's a craft. If you're a bike builder, that's a craft. If you're a wind turbine engineer, that can be a craft. So I think I don't want people to think craft is simply about the past. It's about the way people use their bodies to make things.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about Britain's walls? Because I didn't realise quite how important our wall making has been.
Yes. So the first chapter of Craftland of the book is about dry stone walling. And I begin the book with dry stone walling because it's in many ways the biggest craft. So did you know that we have, I mean, it's impossible to count, but we think we have 125,000 miles of dry stone walls in this country. That's 10 times the length of the Great Wall of China. Strung end to end, they could encircle the Earth's equator 5 times. And those walls, every single one of them was made by hand, with no power tools, on top of a hill or in a field, by an anonymous labourer or mason. It is the most extraordinary thing. And those walls absolutely define our landscape, especially if you come from the north of England. The walls are an absolutely fundamental part of the countryside. And so in chapter one of Craftland, I go to see this amazing walling family. They're called the Nobles. They've been farming this particular valley in West Yorkshire, just south of Huddersfield, for 400 years. They've been masons and wallers for 5 generations. And the 2 youngest generation, there's siblings, there's Cuthbert and Lydia. And they are the finest dry stone wallers pretty much in the world. They are the youngest dry stone wallers. They're only in their early 30s, even younger than me. They are the youngest master dry stone wallers in history. Lydia is one of the only female master dry stone wallers in history. And so they are working in the same job, in the same place as their great-great-grandfathers. I think that's just absolutely extraordinary that could still be happening today.
I mean, in terms of our infrastructure and being able to create long-lasting things, how have we got from that amazing statistic about our dry stone walls to the confusing, obfuscating and downright delayed HS2, James? What's happened?
In fact, when I spoke to the wallers, I spoke to their father, who's now a retired waller, and we stood on top of the hill in West Yorkshire, in the Home Valley, and he said, look at all these walls. They were all, most of the dry stone walls in this country were built in a 100-year period, not over many millennia, but over a 100-year period. He said, we can't build anything nowadays. And look what these people could build. And the quality of their work still stands.
Yeah, they're still standing.
Yeah. But they're coming to the end of their lifetime. So
how do we know?
Well, most dry stone walls, if they're well built, last about 200 years. And most dry stone walls in this country are about 200 years old. And many of them are beginning to degrade and disappear. And there's no funding available to repair them unless a farmer, most farmers don't have that much spare cash, unless a farmer is able to find that money to pay a dry stone waller to repair those walls, they will just, unfortunately, disappear. And a whole part of our heritage will disappear with it as well.
Well, it's a really fascinating book, and it's just beautiful to read as well, because it just takes you to so many places that you might not realise you actually know about. You walk too quickly past things. Mm. You don't recognise, you know, the part of our history played by these magnificent crafts. It's called Craftland. It's by James Fox. The subtitle, A Journey Through Britain's Lost Arts and Vanishing Trades.
It is Times Radio, and it's 5 to 4.
The Sunday Supplement with Alexis Conran on Times Radio with Waitrose. This Sunday afternoon from 1, join Alexis as he welcomes celebrity chef Martha Collinson to the studio to share her passion for the perfect poultry with a delicious chicken recipe she's prepared. Plus, tips and tricks on how to create great-tasting chicken dishes for all the family. The Sunday Supplement with Alexis Conran on Times Radio with Waitrose. The only supermarket where all our chicken checks out against the Better Chicken Commitment Standards or higher.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
Fly direct to Texas and embark on a truly epic road trip adventure, because there's no place on earth like the Lone Star State. Explore miles of music, food, and culture from hill country to the Panhandle Plains. Experience cowboy grit, heritage, legendary hospitality, and those unbeatable cinematic sunsets in the great outdoors. Drive and discover your Texan road adventure at TexasFrontiers.com. Expand your frontiers.
As a small business owner, you've got to be ready for the ups and the downs. Ready to think on your feet, ready to be rushed off your feet, ready to make the big decisions and make the tea. Two sugars in mind? Ta. Ready to be there for your customers whenever they need you. Well, ditto. Virgin Media Broadband's ready for anything business can throw at it. Yeah, it's business-ready broadband. Search Virgin Media Business Broadband.
Thanks to a blend of petrol and electric, fill up less this summer with the self-charging Mazda 2 Hybrid Centerline. It's available to finance for £199 per month with 0% APR representative. To go further for less this summer, search Mazda 2 Hybrid. Mazda Financial Services, PCP over 48 months, deposit of 5395, optional final payment of 9833. Indemnities may be required. Terms apply. See website.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Well, that was interesting, wasn't it, James Fox? That was
riveting. Oh, I thought it was lovely. Yeah. And it is, having, you know, read some of the book, It really does make you look around you a little bit more. And exactly the same with Ray Mears, who you spoke to yesterday about the tracking skills. Mm. It's lovely to read something that kind of wakes you up. You don't have to do it. You're not being asked to do huge amounts of work. But in reading the book, you're learning to look more closely at the world around you. I thought it was just lovely.
Yeah, really, but lovely. I mean, you're right to draw attention to the fact that we are a bit sentimental about working with our hands in the great outdoors.
Oh, freezing work.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it would be absolutely brutal. You'd be totally exhausted and your hands would be, I mean, your manicure would be completely ruined. It's just proper physical graft. It's not all that appealing.
Do you think you and I would have managed?
It's very hard to say. I think it's unlikely. I think we'd probably just have been confined to the house in a kind of keep them where they can do them least damage kind of way.
I'd be making a lot of broth.
I think we'd both be, let's face it, we'd both be wearing witches' hats and we'd be stirring a cauldron. but we'd have enjoyed it in our own way. Now, guests next week, we've had some crackers this week, so thanks to Eve for sorting. But next week, you're going to be talking to somebody called Nick Clegg.
Oh, I've got so many questions, Jane. We've got to try and pack it into 18 to 20 minutes, but there's a lot of questions to ask of Nick Clegg. He's written a book about the crossroads we're at in terms of our relationship with artificial intelligence and technology.
OK, so it is the real Nick Clegg we're talking to. It's not some chatbot called Nick Clegg.
No. It's
okay. Right. Well, that's next week. We're also, we'll be glad to welcome to Times Radio Anna Mihalova, who's the new Times Radio political editor. And she is a fabulous woman. She knows all about politics and she'll be reporting from Westminster as Parliament returns next week. Lots to look forward to. Have a lovely weekend. Who do we need to thank today? Kia Browning, who was our producer and tried to suggest by bawling into my headphones that radio production was a craft. I ignored her. Our technical operator was Ryan, who certainly is a man at ease with his craft. John Pienaar is next. We're back on Monday at 2 o'clock.
across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
It is 4 o'clock. I'm John Pienaar. Welcome to Times Radio Drive, and here are the headlines. The Russian ambassador to Britain has been summoned to the Foreign Office after a massive Russian strike hit a British council building in Kyiv. And two men thought to be asylum seekers have pleaded not guilty over charges related to the alleged rape and abduction of a 12-year-old girl in Warwickshire. And coming up, we're going to be heading to Ukraine as Kyiv reels from another huge Russian attack, which also affected European and UK buildings. I'll be talking to a former Ukrainian prime minister and to a former US ambassador to that country. Does he make a mockery of Trump's attempts to broker peace? And on the Drive debate today, we look at whether it's time to introduce ID cards in a bid to clamp down on illegal migration. The former Home Secretary, David Blunkett, he supports the idea, and Mark Littlewood is against it. Tell me what you think.
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with Martin Williams.
The Foreign Office has summoned Russia's ambassador to the UK after a huge night of missile and drone attacks on Ukraine, during which a British council building and an EU office in Kyiv were hit. Keir Starmer is calling the attack senseless, accusing Vladimir Putin of sabotaging hopes of peace. 4 children were among at least 18 people killed. NATO chief Mark Rutte says he's shocked.
These are attacks not on military targets. These are civilian targets. So you have innocent civilians sleeping at night or during the day going about their business, being attacked by these Russian missiles. Civilian infrastructure being attacked.
2 suspected asylum seekers have pleaded not guilty over charges related to the alleged rape and abduction of a 12-year-old girl in Warwickshire. The claims against Ahmad Mullakil and Mohammed Kabir, who are both 23, have sparked protests in Nuneaton. They've been remanded in custody until November. There are concerns tenants could be facing higher rents as the Treasury considers increasing taxes for landlords. The Times understands officials are examining proposals to apply national insurance to rental income in the hope of raising £2 billion. Times property editor Carol Lewis says the idea has been around for a while.
It's seen by the government as unearned income, so they think it's fair game. The Resolution Foundation, which Torsten Bell, the MP in the Treasury, used to run, put a paper out on this a year ago in which they proposed a new class of national insurance for all landlords. So we don't know exactly how it would work, but if it worked like employee national insurance, it would be 8% on the first 50,000 and 2% thereafter.
The Prime Minister is replacing his top civil servant in Downing Street, but his team's denying suggestions he thinks she's ineffective. Instead, it's understood Private Principal Secretary Nejiri Padit will move to a new role, helping with policy delivery and working on the government's priorities. Sir Keir Starmer's seen a number of high-profile aides depart in the last year, including Chief of Staff Sue Gray. Energy firm Drax is being investigated over the way it sources its biomass materials. A former boss at the company alleged it had misled officials about how it got wood to turn into pellets for renewable power between 2022 and 2024. Drax denies the claims and says it'll cooperate with the Financial Conduct Authority's investigation. And supporters of Grimsby Town are celebrating today after their team drew against Manchester United. The League Two side beat the Premier League giants in a dramatic penalty shootout at Blundell Park after the tie finished 2-2. The town's MP is Labour's Melanie On.
You hope, but you never really think that it's going to go your way. The fact that, you know, they managed to dig in and stay calm and get through those penalties and succeed at the end. I mean, the joy on every single fan's face, and it was just absolutely brilliant.
For a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker, John Pienaar, at Drive, on Times Radio.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. There has been a furious reaction to the latest Russian airstrikes on Kyiv, which have killed at least 17 people, including 4 children. Russia's ambassador in London has been called into the Foreign Office. The EU called the attack a deliberate choice to mock peace efforts. Would it have any effect on President Trump's watch-and-wait approach to tougher sanctions on Russia? I'll be taking soundings on today's show from Kyiv, London and Washington. And a little later, none one of the main childhood vaccines in England reached their uptake targets last year. There are sharp differences across the country, with London lagging behind. What danger does that pose? And how can parents be persuaded to change their mind on immunising their children? I will be talking to a paediatrician and founder of the Vaccine Confidence Project. I want to know what you think about this. Send me a text, 87222, start with the word Times, and a tweet to @TimesRadio. Firstly, last night, Russia launched another major assault on Kyiv. It was the largest since the start of the war. At least 17 people have died. 3 were children. A building used by the British Council was damaged during these strikes. And the Russian ambassador, as I say, had been summoned. Sir Keir Starmer put out a statement on X, and this is what he said.
My thoughts are with all those affected by the senseless Russian strikes on Kyiv, which have damaged the British Council building. Putin is killing children and civilians and sabotaging hopes of peace. This bloodshed must end.
An EU building was also hit, among many civilian homes. The European Commissioner, Ursula von der Leyen, she condemned the attack.
I'm outraged by the attack on Kyiv, also hitting our EU offices. This was the deadliest drone and missile attack on the capital since July. And this is another grim reminder of what is at stake. It shows that the Kremlin will stop at nothing to terrorize Ukraine, blindly killing civilians, men, women and children, and even targeting the European Union. This is why we are keeping maximum pressure on Russia.
The EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen. There is to be a briefing, a news conference at 6 o'clock from the White House, with Caroline Leavitt at the podium. As always, we'll see whether that delivers any kind of response to these attacks from the White House. Meanwhile, bitter fighting continues on the front line in Ukraine. Times' Anthony Lloyd has been talking to Ukrainian soldiers stationed near Sumy.
Due to the amount of drones now, they stay in the trenches or in their foxholes much longer than they used to, you know, months in some cases, because they can't be rotated out by vehicles. It's very difficult to get to them. They're resupplied almost entirely by drones. Drones drop in their water, their food, their ammunition, their cigarettes. And their days are full of, you know, rats are everywhere, feeding off the dead in the no man's land. Flies are everywhere. The whole place stinks. They're very thirsty a lot of the time in the summer fighting as well. Water's scarce. Some of the drone drops of bottled water rupture, so you get 8 guys having to kind of share out one bottle of water between them.
That's Anthony Lloyd reporting. Now, I can welcome to the programme Jimmy Rushton, who's a Ukrainian military analyst. He's based in Kyiv. Hello to you, Jimmy.
Hi, how are you?
Thank you for joining us. So the targets and the casualties, what do we take from this? Again, we saw significant strikes on civilian targets.
Absolutely. It isn't the first time that Russia has struck civilian targets with what are relatively precise missiles. So this isn't a case of Russian munitions going astray and hitting targets they weren't supposed to. The munitions that they used are relatively precise, relatively sophisticated, and they deliberately struck civilian targets. And it's almost certainly a message that Putin feels a sense of impunity, and he's attempting to demonstrate that and to terrorize the Ukrainian people into some form of submission.
Yes, I mean, the aim of breaking the will of the Ukrainian people, making them, I don't know, I suppose more